Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ukrainians will vote again Sunday, a repeat of earlier presidential elections that were scuttled by Ukraine's Supreme Court after weeks of street demonstrations over vote rigging and fraud. Mark McKinnon is with Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. He joins us from Kiev. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko was the official loser last time his supporters took to the street in what's being called the Orange Revolution. But polls put Yushchenko well ahead going into Sunday's vote. How strong is he looking?
He really does seem quite strong right now. The polls had him ahead last time, of course, and before the official results showed that he'd lost. And those polls played a large role in mobilizing street demonstrators and convincing them that he indeed won the election. You do sense an inevitability now to that he's going to that he's likely to win this election. Not only are his supporters very confident of that fact, you kind of get the feeling in the east of the country where I was traveling that they are beginning to accept that their candidate is going to lose this time out.
Yeah, you're in Kiev today. Yesterday you were in Kharkiv, which is in the near the Russian border, the heavily industrial area of Ukraine, which has traditionally supported the prime minister, the Kremlin-backed candidate Viktor Yanukovych. Are you finding support for him still strong there when you were there yesterday?
Kharkiv is a changing city, I think, and it's different from other parts like Donetsk, Mr. Yanukovych's hometown, which is very, very firmly behind him. Kharkiv is an interesting place in that it's quite a cultural and intellectual center, and on the streets it was really a 50-50 when I asked people how they thought, which is very different from just about any other city in Ukraine where people are either firmly in one camp or firmly in the other.
What are the indications that either candidate will accept the results of this poll?
Mr. Yushchenko's camp has made it clear that if their candidate didn't win, the way they put it is if there's a repeat of the fraud, what they mean is if their candidate doesn't win, they're going to return to the streets. Mr. Yanukovych's camp has previously condemned this sort of a reaction as illegal, but you're starting to see in the areas where the deepest support is, talk of, well, maybe we'll have to march to Kiev this time if we lose. And there certainly will be court challenges. I can't imagine that this story actually ends Sunday.
And in parallel with this whole saga of an election rerun has been the very strange story of the poisoning of opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko by dioxin. The secret police, who he accused of poisoning him, yesterday belatedly denied any wrongdoing. There are all kinds of rumors circulating on the internet that Yushchenko might have poisoned himself. Is that crazy?
I certainly think that's crazy. There is some belief in the Yanukovych camp that perhaps some of the people around him, some of the people who would see themselves as the Democrat, the successor to the opposition leader thrown in this presidential race, may have done this. But again, that's really far-fetched, and so there's no evidence at all to support this.
Yushchenko has been portrayed very much in the press here as the reformer, the Democrat, the Western-allied candidate. Who are the people around Yushchenko, and what's their background?
His critics would say, or rather what the critics of the opposition would say, is the people around Mr. Yushchenko are really no different from the ones they're criticizing. These are oligarchs, people who made a lot of money in the early 1990s, and who gradually fell out with President Leonid Kuchma and his regime. And, you know, they accuse him of just basically adopting democratic wording, democratic cloaking.
Is that a fair criticism?
It's fair to say that some of these people who are at the forefront of the Democratic, the opposition movement, have made some rather stunning conversions. But over the course of some years, the question is, did they really convert? Did they really see the light after a few years where they made a lot of money on the quick? Or did they just simply see this as being political advantage? But I tend to think the most important thing is these people who are on the street. The tens of thousands who demonstrated every day in Kiev, what they saw was not bought or paid for.
And Mark, maybe finally we should just explain that Sunday, December 26th, is not the day after Christmas in Ukraine.
No, it's not. Although it has made rounding up Western observers something of a challenge. Of course, the Ukrainians, most Ukrainians, celebrate the Orthodox Christmas on January the 7th. And there shouldn't be a problem in terms of voter turnout, although convincing some observers to leave home for this period from Western countries was a bit of a challenge, although there is a record number, more than 12,000 have come here.
Well, we appreciate your time on Christmas Eve, Mark. Merry Christmas to you.
Thanks very much. Yourself, too.
Mark McKinnon is Moscow bureau chief for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. He spoke to us from Kiev, Ukraine. With the fall of Baghdad in April 2003, among the casualties were thousands of precious works of art looted from Iraq's National Museum. To investigate the thefts, the U.S. Marine sent one Colonel Matthew Bogdanos, who in civilian life is a New York prosecuting attorney, a middleweight boxer with a 23-3 record, and something of a classical scholar. More than a year and a half later, Colonel Bogdanos remains engaged in the hunt. He joins us from Central Command headquarters in Florida. Welcome.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you for having me.
You actually asked to lead this investigation.
Yes, sir, that's true. When this happened, I was the head of a multiple agency team. We were conducting counterterrorism operations in Basra. As soon as I heard about the looting of the National Museum from my prior studies, I was aware of what an absolute disaster and tragedy that would be. I requested permission from General Franks to take part of my larger task force up to Baghdad.
What did you know then about what was in that museum?
Well, I knew that it housed some of the finest antiquities known to mankind, and this is coming from a Greek American, so that's saying something. It housed particularly the sacred vase of Warka, a Sumerian vase from about 3200 BC. I knew it also housed the famous mask of Warka, commonly called the Mona Lisa of Mesopotamia, another Sumerian piece from about 3100 BC. It also housed the Bezetki statues. It's exquisite copper statue, as well as the first known bronze bulls in relief. Pretty much it was a who's who of Near Eastern archaeology.
Tell me about some of these things. Things like the Mona Lisa are household names, but most of us have never heard of, say, the Bezetki statue. What's that like?
It's a copper statue. It's about 330 pounds altogether. It was from about 2400 BC, and it was used actually as a doorstop in southern Iraq. It's an Akkadian piece, and it is just extraordinary in its workmanship. And what you need to remember about the Iraq National Museum is that everything you're looking at is the first. The first, you know, mask depicting a human being, a naturalist depiction of a human being, the vase, the first vase depicting human life, the Bezetki statue, the first statue, you know, built in that way in copper.
And that Bezetki statue is one of the things that hasn't been recovered. Is that right?
No, fortunately it has. It was found in November. It had been dumped into a cesspool in Baghdad. Obviously, the thieves realized that it was simply too hot to move, so they dumped it into a cesspool, hoping to retrieve it when the publicity surrounding the theft was over. Fortunately, informants led American military MPs to that cesspool before it could be moved.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
And?
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Informants were extremely important when you started to recover some of these artifacts, but it must have been difficult to walk into a chaotic situation like that as part of an invading army and build trust.
Yeah, and you really hit the nail on the head, Alan. Trust in conducting law enforcement operations in New York is the number one thing you need. Well, trust in conducting law enforcement operations in Iraq is also the number one thing. So, but you have to go about it in a different way. And the way we chose to build the trust in Iraq was to show trust first. So one of the first things I did when we arrived in Baghdad, and now this is, of course, you know, mid-April, is I chose to walk the streets without helmets, showing as an act of good faith that we trusted the Iraqis. I didn't like the message that helmets sent.
Mm.
And I also walked from marketplace to marketplace, mosque to mosque, tea house to tea house, drinking more tea, frankly, than I thought should be possible in any five lifetimes. And I also sat down and talked with Iraqis about their place in history. I talked to them about the fact that their culture, the Iraqi culture, I mean, is the cradle of civilization. Every single American can trace our roots ultimately, you know, through some indirect means to Iraq itself. And I explained to them how important it was not only for them, but for us and for all mankind. And I can't begin to stress how remarkably courageous and cooperative the Iraqi people were. They were extraordinary. They were friendly. They were outgoing. Initially, of course, they were cautious. But once we earned their trust, it was a trust that was given to us, and it was never violated. In all the times we were in Baghdad, all the raids that we conducted based on information we received from informants, not once were we ever led into a trap. Not once were we ever led into an ambush.
And most Iraqis, of course, are Muslim, which is a relatively recent, in the terms of Babylonia or Mesopotamia, a relatively recent arrival. Do they, in your experience, have a cultural connection with these ancient artifacts?
Many of them, in truth, many of them did not. But they appreciated that it was something important, that it was something meaningful. And in many occasions, the looters, for example, the looters randomly stole, you know, over 3,000 excavation site pieces from several of the storage rooms. Once they were, it was explained to them frequently by imams and local community and religious leaders how important these things were, they came back in droves. And I mean, we recovered close to 1,900 pieces, each one in and of itself priceless and precious, through the amnesty program.
And your career, your skill as a boxer actually became important in one occasion, I understand.
Yes, and of course I would never say skill as a boxer, but yes, my background as a boxer, we were did come in handy. We were at a coffee shop one time in Baghdad. I was there with several of the members of my team, and my partner needed to meet an informant in the back of the coffee shop, and I needed to distract the attention of the people in the coffee shop so that he could do so quietly. We had made friends with a gentleman who had been a former professional boxer and had actually boxed in Los Angeles many years before. He'd become like the mascot of that particular coffee shop. So he and I began playfully sparring in the front of the coffee shop while my partner was getting information in the back of the coffee shop. Now, I want to say playfully sparring. However, he was a heavyweight who was as big as he was smooth. And truthfully, if I close my eyes, I can still feel the right hand of his, because it was a good one. But he was a great guy.
The things you do for art. I'm talking with Colonel Matthew Bogdanos. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with Matthew Bogdanos, the Marine reservist who led the effort to recover artifacts stolen from the Iraqi National Museum in Baghdad last year. Colonel, the original reports of that looting were terrible. 170,000 artifacts was the number we all heard. The real number ended up being somewhat lower.
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, I heard the same numbers that you did initially. That was over 170,000 of the artifacts were taken. Fortunately, that turned out to be a gross exaggeration.
You actually break the thefts down into sort of three different waves.
Yes, sir. And there really were three separate dynamics at play. You have the professional thieves who took the most priceless pieces, 40 separate pieces were taken, of which 15 have been recovered. But these 40 are the most recognizable and priceless pieces known to mankind. So even though there are only 25 pieces missing, each and every one of those pieces is an absolute tragedy. Then you have a group of insiders who accessed the remote basement, who had keys, who knew what they were looking for, and they stole approximately 11,000 smaller pieces. And then you have the random looters, the neighborhood people, who went into the above-ground storage rooms, and they stole upwards of 3,000 excavation site pieces, pottery jars, vessels, statuettes, amulets, and the like. The vast majority of those have been recovered.
You've suggested at various times that some of these thefts may have been pre-ordered, planned in advance of the invasion, and carried out on instructions. What's the evidence for that?
Well, there's both inductive and deductive evidence for the fact that any of those items, the particularly recognizable items, were in fact sold before they were stolen. Many of these items, the sacred vase of Wartka, the mask, the Bezetsky statue, they simply cannot be moved through international commerce safely. You can't find a buyer for these after you've stolen them. You need a buyer for these items before they're stolen, because there are only half a dozen to a dozen people in the world who will spend the tens of millions of dollars for an object that they can never publicly acknowledge owning and can never show to anyone but their closest friends.
And who are these buyers?
There are a handful of collectors, primarily New York, London, and Tokyo, as the evidence has shown us, who are willing to spend this kind of money for those kinds of items. The real tragedy, however, is the facilitators, the people who enable them to buy this. If you're a collector and you're willing to spend $20 million for the sacred vase of Wartka, the number one thing you're going to want to know is that it's authentic. Mm. You want to know that it's the real thing. Well, if you're going to spend that kind of money, you don't want a graduate student. You don't want a journalist. What you want is an expert in the field. You want a name that you recognize. You want someone who has published. You want someone who's a curator of a major museum. And what we have found time and time again is that there are many in the mainstream art and archaeological community who are willing to authenticate these pieces.
Have you been able to arrest any of these people?
The one thing I can't talk about is any open investigations, because what you hope to do in any kind of law enforcement investigation of this magnitude is you hope to arrest individuals, then not publicly announce that arrest, then flip that person in order to get that person to become a confidential informant.
Why would scholars act as middlemen in thefts like this? These are people who spent their life studying these things. Why would they facilitate them going to unscrupulous private collectors?
One of the most fascinating components of this investigation is that frequently it's not the money. Frequently it is the excitement. Frequently it's the opportunity to see an item that they've only ever heard about and ultimately then be able to write and publish on it. And then sometimes it's money. And sometimes it's a museum that's promised the piece after the individual dies.
Hmm. You're so passionate about this. Let me ask you, if you had it in your power to control that invasion, would you have protected the museum at the same time that the oil ministry was protected?
See, that's an interesting question, because you actually, in the question, you assume certain things that aren't accurate. And let me point this out. When people argue that U.S. forces should have done a better job in protecting the museum, I agree with them. But if you look at the facts, it's difficult to know what we could have done differently. The fact is that Iraqi army forces fortified the museum. We found four firing positions on the museum grounds. We found a sniper position inside the museum grounds.
Colonel, I take your point, Colonel, but U.S. forces got to Baghdad on April 7th. On April 10th, the oil ministry was secured. On the 11th and 12th, Western journalists were in the museum when the looting was still going on. It's the 16th before U.S. troops get to the museum.
Yes, sir. And fortunately, all the looting is completed by the 12th. When the staff and journalists return on the afternoon of the 12th, there is no longer any looting after that.
There were still Western journalists there a week before U.S. forces got there.
Western journalists are not in uniform, and Western journalists weren't fired on by Iraqis.
Let me just finish, Colonel, by saying you won't want to go back to the humdrum business of murder investigations after all this. Do you have any thought of becoming a sort of professional investigator in the underworld of international art theft?
No, I don't. Though when I do return to New York, when I get off active duty and I return to the district attorney's office, I do plan on establishing New York City's first antiquities investigative task force in order to continue this work. But I also plan on going back to doing homicides as well.
Well, we wish you luck.
Thank you, sir.
Colonel Matthew Bogdanov spoke to us from Central Command in Florida. You can see some of the artwork we talked about on our website, here-now.org. Next week on Here and Now, who will lead the Democratic Party? And how will the Democrats handle issues like abortion and moral values? Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Embattled Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made a surprise Christmas visit to Iraq today. He spoke this morning to troops in Mosul.
I wish you all a Merry Christmas and the very best of holidays. I know that you've got loved ones, that it's not easy being away from loved ones. But know that they're strong, and know that they love you, and know that they're proud of you. So God bless you, each of you and your families, and God bless our country. Thank you very much.
And joining us from Mosul is Bill Nemitz of the Portland Press Herald. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Alan.
Secretary Rumsfeld was in Iraq to support the troops, but this was also an important public relations visit for the defense secretary. How was he received today?
Well, I'm on forward operating base Marez, where the attack took place last Tuesday, and the secretary didn't actually visit forward operating base Marez. He was at two places during his time here in Mosul. One was Camp Diamondback, where the combat support hospital is located. He visited with some of the wounded soldiers who remain there. Then he went over to Camp Freedom, which is the headquarters for Task Force Olympia up here in northern Iraq. And the remarks to the soldiers were made during a breakfast over there at Camp Freedom. I did speak by phone with one of our main soldiers that I'm embedded with, the 133rd Engineer Battalion. He was actually awakened at 4:30 this morning and asked if he wanted to have breakfast with the Secretary of Defense. He said sure, and the next thing he knew, he was sitting down to eggs and coffee with Donald Rumsfeld.
2 weeks ago, on a visit to Kuwait, the Secretary came under some pretty tough questioning from soldiers. Is there any indication, any way to know whether the questions he took this time were in any way pre-screened?
Well, I spoke by telephone from this base here. It's about 5 miles across Mosul, and not a trip you want to take that often, with Staff Sergeant Harold Fitch, who was the one who had breakfast with him. I asked specifically if he was grilled by any of the soldiers or if they got into any real specifics about the attack. Sergeant Fitch said no, it was much more kind of socializing than that. It certainly wasn't anything approaching the exchange that took place a couple of weeks ago in Kuwait.
One soldier asked the defense secretary today, how do we win the war in the media? Is there a widespread sense among the troops that you're talking to there that things are going substantially better in Iraq than what the press is reporting?
That would be a hard one to answer right now. This is my second trip here, and both times I've certainly come across a number of soldiers who will tell you that from their perspective, the so-called good story or the things they're accomplishing over here seem to go underreported, particularly for an engineer battalion, because they're building the hospitals, they're rebuilding the schools, doing a lot of the infrastructure work that doesn't often make its way into mainstream media. That's, however, changed somewhat given what happened up here on Tuesday. I think what we're dealing with here at the moment is just a camp that is still very much in shock and very much, in grief over the fact that so many soldiers were lost. While the secretary was at Camp Freedom this morning, the 133rd was holding the first of what will be, I think, about a half a dozen memorial services over here for the soldiers who were killed.
Bill Nemitz, thanks a lot.
Okay, Alan.
Bill Nemitz is with Maine's Portland Press Herald. He spoke with us from Mosul, Iraq. You might know this scene. The babysitter gets sick or the kids are out of school, but you have to work. So what to do? Well, one of the nation's top retailers has an answer. The Wisconsin-based catalog and internet company Land's End offers its own employees something called backup childcare, especially for those times when no one's available to watch their children. Dennis Honan is Land's End Chief Operating Officer. He joins us on the line from Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Welcome.
Great to be here, Alan. Thank you.
Well, I imagine this is a busy time of year for your company, Land's End, and for the backup child care facility.
Yes, it is a busy time for all of our people as well as our child care facility.
How does this all work?
Well, our backup child facility was set up really to take care of our employees. You know, if you know anything about Land's End, we're out here in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, and we're the major employer in this part of the state. So we do feel an obligation to take care of our employees, and sometimes they just don't have anyone who can take care of their children. Their primary provider may be sick, maybe not available, the kids may be off from school. So we offer the backup daycare as a great place for their kids, and also allows them, obviously, to come into work and get paid and to take care of their family at the same time.
And this is not just a Christmas service that you're offering. This runs all year.
No, we do it all year. I have two little girls, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and they oftentimes use a facility, and they absolutely love it.
So your employees take care of their own arrangements for daycare, but if things don't work out, they can go to the backup.
Absolutely.
We understand that facilities like these are somewhat rare. The company that runs your facilities, Bright Horizons, tells us there are only about 130 or so backup daycare centers in the country. How do you think this works to Land's End advantage in terms of your employees?
Well, Alan, we have always focused on making Land's End a great place to work. We listen to what our employees tell us. We listen to what their problems and issues are. And we know that employees have, at times, a difficult time if their primary care provider is unavailable, whether it's another daycare facility or it's a spouse or another provider. So by having this available, it definitely makes Land's End a better place to work. It makes for happier, more energized, excited employees. And it also makes them more productive because they show up for work. They show up for work when they're planned to show up for work, and they're happier because they're getting paid.
How altruistic is this on your part? Have you done the numbers to see if you're retaining employees longer and absenteeism goes down? Does it actually pay for itself, or is it something that you do partly as a service to your employees?
I would say, Alan, we definitely look at it as a service to our employees. This is very difficult to quantify. But it's part of when we think about Land's End as a great place to work, this is just one component of that. It's the way we give our employees a flexible schedule. It's our activity center in our pool and, you know, weekend swimming lessons for their kids and things like that makes it a great place to work.
Sounds like a good deal. But if I'm working for you, what prevents me from abusing it? What if I just cancel my regular daycare and drop the kids off at the backup plan?
Well, first and foremost, we trust our employees, and the vast majority of them, in fact, I can't even think of any abuses over the years on our backup daycare centers. We trust our employees not to abuse the privileges that we give them, and they all are responsible employees. There is a limit, though, that we give to our employees. They only are allowed 20 days a year. But, you know, again, though, having said that, if the daycare center has capacity and an employee wants their children here more than 20 days, we certainly accommodate them. We don't make it a hard and fast rule. We look at each individual employee's situation.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Great. Thank you, Alan.
Dennis Honan is Chief Operating Officer of Land's End. He spoke to us from Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Just ahead, the angelic voices of King's College Choir. You're listening to Here and Now. Christmas shopping can be one of the more frustrating holiday activities. There's the search for parking, the crowds at the malls, and then there's the problem of finding just the right gift. Well, enter the Bazaar Christmas Bazaar, an alternative shopping experience hatched a few years ago in Massachusetts, which has now spread to Cleveland, Ohio, and Los Angeles. Here Now's Lindsay Crudell went to the bazaar in Cambridge and asked organizer Simone Alpin what's so bizarre about her bazaar.
Bizarre because it's not like any other craft fair, because most craft fairs are sort of in church basements or tend to be sort of kind of cheesy grandma crafts, which there's nothing wrong with that, actually. I am a big fan generally, but I think the style here is, I think most of the vendors and the attendees tend to be in their 20s and 30s, and I think people are really looking for handmade gifts at this time of year because there's so much pressure to shop in malls or, you know, big giant box stores, so this provides a really great alternative.
A couple of the crafts that you might see inside.
Inside, there's a lot of really nicely made handbags, like small handbags. There's a lot of silkscreen t-shirts with really cool, it tends to be a lot of the men tend to do the silkscreen t-shirts.
We have some crafts, we have some handmade record covers here, and some leather True Love Always bracelets.
We have stuffed food dolls, and paintings, and yarn.
Hand knits. I have a porno latch hook kit.
Let's see, there's lots of jewelry. There's lots of things made from recycled goods, which I think is a pretty interesting trend, but there's a lot of jewelry made from dice or old antique mahjong tiles.
2x2 envelopes made of found materials, and I'm also selling a bunch of decorated boxes with book cloth and some Christmas crackers, British style, with a sort of off-color expressions inside.
Selling stuffed animals that are sort of odd and kind of malformed. Some only have one leg, some only have one arm.
And you made all of these?
I made them all, and I dyed a lot of the fabrics as well.
Do you think that there's been a resurgence of young people doing their own crafts lately?
I do. When we started 4 years ago, it was really, there's more and more people crafting themselves. I think there's more and more people interested in getting hand goods or, you know, learning from other people, like what they've made. I don't know if it started with the knitting revolution in the last few years. Part of it might be that when the economy sort of blew up, I think a lot of people in their 20s and 30s decided that they were going to switch their high-powered jobs for something more relaxing like knitting or crafting or sewing, and maybe it all comes from that. I know for myself, my mom never taught me to do any handicrafts because she wasn't interested in it, because she was a very women's lib kind of person, and she never, I think she learned all of those crafts, but she never, that was never important to her at the time to pass along. You know, now I think I missed that I didn't get to learn those things, so I just learned those things in the last few years. I think probably like 10 years ago, probably wasn't in any way cool or progressive in any way. And I think now people are much more open to that and they're excited by it. And I think it is a little bit about sort of reaching back and regaining that history.
Bah, humbug, well that's too strong, 'cause it is my favorite holiday. But all this year has been a busy blur. Don't think I have the energy. Red am I already mad rush, just 'cause it's 'tis the season. The perfect gift for me would be completions and connections.
connections left from last year. Ski shop encounter, most interesting. Had his number, but never the time. Most of 81 pass along those lines. So deck those halls, trim those trees.
Our visit to the Bazaar Christmas Bazaar was produced by Lindsay Crudell. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Hail the picture, frozen landscape, chilled this room for 24 days. Evergreen, sparkling snow, get this winter over with. Flashback to springtime, saw him again. Would have been good to go for lunch. Couldn't agree, we were both free. We tried, we said we'd keep in touch. Didn't, of course, till summertime. Out to the beach, to his boat, could I join him? No, this time it was me.
I'm Ellen Cockle. It's Here and Now. For many people around the world, the sound of Christmas is the voices of the King's College Choir in Cambridge, England. On this Christmas Eve, we revisit the choir with Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb.
Once in Royal David City, the traditional opening carol in the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols sung by the choir of King's College in Cambridge, and broadcast from King's Live by the BBC each Christmas Eve. The choir's distinctive sound comes from its contingent of 16 boy sopranos, all students at King's College School.
Oh, my God!
Right, have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Did matron give you some lip silk?
Yeah, I've got some rose. Thanks.
Just past eight on a pale winter morning, and a group of schoolboys are giving the lie to Shakespeare, not creeping like snails unwillingly to school, but striding purposefully to the rehearsal room for morning choir practice.
Say, ah.
Ah.
Ah. Ah.
Ah.
There has been a school associated with King's College Cambridge since it was founded. The king in question is Henry VI, who established the college in the middle of the 15th century. The original charter called for a chapel to be built and for a special school to educate the boy sopranos, called trebles, who would be part of the choir that sang there. Today, King's College School is a prep school running from kindergarten to the equivalent of ninth grade. In addition to the choristers, there are 300 other students. Most of their classmates live at home, but the choristers must live at the school. The choristers are between 10 and 13 years old. They're selected through a rolling admission process. Most do not come from a trained music background. They're selected more for their innate musicality, according to music director Stephen Cleobury.
Each child has a voice which is unique to himself. And so the main aim is to help them develop that instrument to its full potential, and to teach them how to integrate the voice that they have, the sound that they make, into the whole picture.
This morning's rehearsal is focused on the motet Ave Maria by the 16th century composer Robert Parsons. The 8 a.m. rehearsal is not the start of the boys' music day. They have to study piano and one other instrument. The important thing to understand about this remarkable group is that their relationship to music is different from those of musical prodigies. Talking to Fergus Thirlwell, I got the sense that for him, music wasn't a calling so much as all he knew from his academic environment.
Oh, I didn't really have any old friends because I came to the school when I was four or something like that, so I've just made all my friends that I have now.
Fergus has a particular taste in the music he sings.
Like if we sing Lassus, it's quite boring. But
sing what?
Lassus, it's early music. Some of it's quite nice, but usually we enjoy singing the modern pieces by jazzy and stuff.
Few of the boys will take up professional performing careers, although most will have music in their lives, although perhaps not to the degree that Fergus Thirlwell dreams of.
For a bit, I wanted to be a pop star, but I don't anymore. I don't know.
Why don't you want to be a pop star?
Because I don't know. I don't think it suits me. I prefer to be a songwriter.
The second rehearsal of the day is in the late afternoon. The boys put on their Eatons, morning suit, ruffled shirt, and top hat similar to the outfit worn at the famous public school Eton, also founded by Henry VI, and walk from the school over the backs to the chapel for full choir rehearsal. It's a bit of a local spectacle, this daily parade. In the chapel, the choristers meet up with the more adult members of the choir. More adult, but not entirely mature. They're all undergraduates at King's College, and Cleo Berry begins his no-nonsense rehearsal, working through the Parsons Motet with the full choir. Essential component to the King's College sound, the chapel itself, a masterpiece of late Gothic architecture. King's College Chapel is a rectangular box as long as a football field, 40 feet wide and 80 feet high. The ceiling is masonry sculpted into fan shapes. The sound ripples along the stone like a stream at the source, breaking forth from the ground and babbling over rocks. The sound is transporting, and listening to the boys sing, you're struck by the music's beauty and this sad fact. For all of them, their gift is fleeting. Puberty strikes, their voices break, and their days in the choir are over. I asked music director Stephen Cleobury if there were any voices that were so beautiful he wished they would never grow old.
Oh, undoubtedly, it's a sad thing for me when I, you know, because often, now that boys' voices change at an earlier age than used to be the case.
Really?
Oh, yes. I mean, Bach, when he was he himself was a boy treble, and indeed the boy trebles that he trained at St. Thomas in Leipzig, you know, he would be having boys singing soprano up to the age of 16 or 17. Well, now it's very rare for them to get much beyond 14. In a sense, I mean, it's no different from life, is it? I mean, life is like a flower. We were singing the Brahms Requiem last night in chapel with the university chorus. Behold, all flesh is as the grass. You know, it groweth up and withereth. And that's certainly true of a boy's voice in a very particular sense. Well, you're trying to train them to achieve a good potential and degree of experience and quality of sound, you know, before that time comes when the voice changes. And that can be for them, it varies from boy to boy. For some of them it's a point of great sadness and regret. For others, it's a release.
But sic transit, the glory of the choir remains. And Christmas is when the ever-changing cast of voices glows most brightly.
Here and now is Michael Goldfarb. For more information on the King's College Choir, visit our website at here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Mike Toda is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our intern is Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Ellen Cockle. Robin Young is back on Monday. From all of us here, Merry Christmas, and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.